It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're well into WPR's first week of reorganized statewide networks and new programming schedules. This network is called WPR News. Our music network is called WPR Music. For full schedules and signals, head over to WPR.org/new.
You can also listen to WPR News or WPR Music online anytime at WPR.org. Stay with us on Wisconsin Today.
Tuesday marked the very first run of the Amtrak Borealis route. It stretches across Wisconsin from Chicago to the Twin Cities.
The Borealis will run daily, adding to the service already offered by Amtrak's Empire Builder, which runs from Chicago to Washington State.
Lisa Stern worked on the route as the Chief of Railroads and Harbors at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She's here to tell us more about the new service and how it might affect transportation in the state. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Take us on a tour, please. What are the basics of the Borealis route?
Yeah, thanks. So the Borealis route, as you said, will complement the existing Empire Builder. It's going to leave from both Chicago and the Twin Cities, St. Paul, actually, around 11 to 11:30 in the morning, and then arrive at the other destinations around between 6:30 and 7. So it's a very convenient time frame. It'll be running through Wisconsin through the middle of the day, and it will also provide a much more reliable schedule eastbound. I think a lot of people have been using the Empire Builder, and if you have, you know that sometimes that trip from Seattle back to Chicago has significant delays. But with this route, it will be just between the Twin Cities and Chicago, and it will be much more reliable schedule. So that's what we're looking for.
What do you know about demand for this new route? You've built it. Will the passengers come and ride the rails?
Yeah, well, the passengers are already coming. So as you know, this did start on Tuesday, and we have very high levels of trains tickets being sold already. I think this weekend we were looking at 70% of the train already being sold out earlier this week. So there is a demand there. And actually, when we were looking at the service to start with and evaluating the Empire Builder, 60% of the people who got on and off with got on in Wisconsin got off within this route. So there was already a demand. There was a lot of people using the Empire Builder for this regional travel. So the demand is out there. We are seeing great ticket sales already. So the riders seem to be picking up on the service.
I know there were celebratory all aboards in Chicago and St. Paul. Did we have some celebrations in Wisconsin cities that are stops on the route?
Yes, we did. We had our big celebration in La Crosse, where our governor and Department of Transportation and Tourism both were there to celebrate. I personally participated in the Columbus celebration. Portage had a celebration, Toma, and then Milwaukee as well. So we had a lot of communities here in the state were extremely excited to see the service get started, and they showed their support on Tuesday. So it was great.
The Borealis, I understand, was years in the making, Lisa. What does it take to make something like this happen?
Yes. Yeah, it has been years in the making. It takes a lot of partnership and a lot of dedication. You know, this is a service that spans three states. So you're coordinating, you know, through the rules and regulations of three different states. You've got Amtrak, and we're running on Canadian Pacific Kansas Southern, or CPKC's tracks. And then we have our funding partners with the Federal Railroad Administration. So there's a lot of things to coordinate and a lot of agreements at the stations and other things, the communities along the way. So all that coordination takes time, but we had a great dedicated team with all our partners, and we were able to make it happen this Tuesday. It was very exciting. It was a great accomplishment.
Maybe I'm a big nerd, Lisa, but I wonder about the logistics here. These tracks, obviously the Empire Builder runs, I believe, on the same track. Freight rail may run on the same track. How much of a burden is it to say, okay, yeah, we're going to have a new passenger line running each way once per day on those tracks?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that actually is a lot of what the evaluation and negotiations with the host railroad, as we call CPKC, they technically own the tracks. So their main business, order of business, is running freight trains. So we have to work with them to look at what can we do for passenger trains that will not, you know, impact their freight operations negatively. We have a great partner with CPKC, and we're currently building additional infrastructure in La Crosse and Winona, the Winona area in Minnesota, to accommodate the future growth here. But the CPKC realized that they could allow this train to get started, you know, with the current situation. So that is something we have to look at, and we call it RTC modeling or rail train modeling. So we look at the freight trains, the passenger trains, and they all kind of evaluated to make sure that they can all fit on the rails. Lisa, so that is a big part of the evaluation.
Lisa Stern is with us, Chief of Railroads and Harbors at Wisconsin's Department of Transportation, talking about the Borealis, a new Amtrak route just kicked off this week. It runs across Wisconsin from Chicago to the Twin Cities. Lisa, how does taking the Borealis across Wisconsin compare to driving when it comes to things like price, efficiency, and environmental impact?
Yeah, so so the price to ride the Borealis will be kind of what we call revenue management. So the cost will depend on how early you book your ticket and how busy the train is. So on holiday weekends, it will tend to the price will tend to grow higher. You know, this opening week, we were selling tickets between Chicago and the Twin Cities. It's starting at $41. The price will, like I said, can increase to over 100, depending on if there's not very many seats left on the holiday weekend. So that's for the full route. And then it'll vary if you're getting on in Portage and going to La Crosse, it'll be a smaller amount. And again, it will also vary. The full train distance takes from Chicago to the Twin Cities will take about 7.5 hours, which is about an hour longer than driving with no stops. But of course, you know, you can get up on the train. We'll have a cafe car. We do have a cafe car there. The cafe car also, we've made a big effort working with Amtrak and Minnesota and Illinois to provide some local fare there for people to enjoy. The other thing is, you know, trains are an environmentally friendly option for people to take to use for transportation. Additionally, it's great for business travel. If you're going there for business, you can get, you know, emails done, get reading done on the train, or you can just relax and get ready for whatever, you know, you're attending to at your destination.
What do routes like this do for a local economy, for cities along the route?
Yeah, this type of route is especially, you know, it's great. It does connect these large urban areas, but it's especially important for our smaller communities along these routes. This provides economic development opportunities. It's a selling point for those communities to bring business into their areas because it connects them to these large urban areas. Additionally, I think it helps families that live in these areas. You know, maybe their kid goes to college in La Crosse or at the University of Minnesota, and now this is a great way for their, you know, family to use that to get back and forth between school and home. So it also can help tourism in these communities. Of course, one of the stops is the Dells, so that will be a great help for those who don't want to drive on the interstate on those weekends coming back from the Dells or going to the Dells, so they can take the train as well.
There are groups out there calling for new passenger rail connections, including Wisconsin's second and third largest cities, Madison and Green Bay. What would have to happen to expand to cities that don't currently have that train stop?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently, the Federal Railroad Administration has created this new program. It's called the Corridor ID program. And Wisconsin DOT submitted 4 different projects, and we were awarded all 4. So those projects will look at expanding passenger rail in Wisconsin, and that includes to Madison, that includes to Green Bay, and also an Eau Claire connection. And Eau Claire County actually also submitted their own, so there'll be a study looking at connecting Eau Claire to the Twin Cities as well. And Minnesota, we're also working with Minnesota on their Northern Lights Express, which will connect the Twin Cities up to the Duluth Superior. And so this whole program will look at that exact question. What do we need? Where does it make sense to expand passenger rail? What do we need to do if we decide that that's the way we want to move forward? So we're just in the very beginning. We just signed the grant agreements actually this week for those. So we're just getting started.
For people who don't live in towns on the Borealis route right now, what kind of connection options are out there? Buses, shuttles, park and ride, what have you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently, Wisconsin DOT supports a bus connection to the Green Bay area, to the Hiawatha. So that's one option that's been very popular and successful, even though I think one of the buses leaves at 4:30 a.m. from Green Bay, but it still gets a lot of use. There's also some private bus connections between Madison and Columbus. And one of the issues has been in the past, just because of the unreliability of the eastbound Empire Builder, that the bus connection doesn't always connect up. But that problem should be solved with this new Borealis. We'll be able to provide better bus connections. And then we're working on adding a bus connection between Eau Claire and Toma. So that is something that will be coming in the works in the hopefully near future.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Lisa Stern, Chief of Railroads and Harbors at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. We talked to her about the Borealis, a new Amtrak route that runs across Wisconsin from Chicago to the Twin Cities. Are you planning to ride the Borealis? Have you already been on it this week? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Send pictures.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today, and when you're looking for the top news from around the state, check out WPR's podcast called Wisconsin Today Morning News.
It's available now. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts, or head over to WPR.org.
Just ahead on Wisconsin Today, a World Air Quality Report ranks the air in Beloit as the worst in the country. We learn about the citizen scientists who led a project to survey their city's air for the first time and what they discovered about pollutants. That's up next on WPR.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Businesses across Wisconsin are ramping up hiring in preparation for the summer months when teens join Wisconsin's labor force.
As Joe Schultz reports, this year's summer tourism season comes after a political standoff over a Republican bill that would have removed work permit requirements for the state's youngest workers.
There we go.
Thank you. You guys are the best. Yeah.
Last weekend was the first of the summer for Wilson's Restaurant and Ice Cream Parlor in Door County. Walking inside the century-old building is almost like stepping back in time. Teens take ice cream orders behind a counter as oldies music pours out of a jukebox that still plays records. Well, I saved my pennies and I saved my dimes. Each summer, Wilson's hires about 70 seasonal employees. Roughly a third of them are high school-aged. Sarah Martin is a former teacher who owns the business with her husband. She says she loves giving teens their first work experience.
A lot of people ask if I miss teaching, and I'm like, I really don't feel that far removed from it. It's just a different type of teaching.
Wilson's isn't the only place ramping up for the summer season. More than 35,000 14 and 15-year-olds join Wisconsin's workforce each year. That's according to state data. May and June are traditionally the months the state issues the most work permits each year. 16 and 17-year-olds in Wisconsin no longer need work permits, but state data shows a larger share of Wisconsin's older teens are either working or looking for work than the share nationally. But summer hiring has been a mixed bag this year. Some employers say it's been easier to hire, while others say it's been difficult. Susan Quam is with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association.
Everybody's still scrambling pretty hard to find and fill their summer workforce. We're just, even with the great participation rate compared to the country, it's still, you know, not meeting the needs we have in our tourism months.
The season comes after Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill that would have removed work permit requirements for 14 and 15-year-olds. The proposal had backing from several business groups. The Wisconsin Restaurant Association took a neutral stance on it. Quam says the law that removed work permits for 16 and 17-year-olds has streamlined hiring, but restaurants feared the bill for younger teens would have exposed them to legal liability. That's because 14 and 15-year-olds are subject to strict federal restrictions on the hours they can work and the equipment they can use. Quam says the work permit process helps protect restaurants because it ensures parents and employers review the restrictions they need to follow. Martin with the Door County Ice Cream Parlor agreed with the association's position.
I do think it makes sense for the 14, 15-year-olds. They can't drive. You know, they're just getting in the workforce. You don't want them overdoing it, and you want to make sure their parents are in the loop.
Between 2018 and 2022, Wisconsin had the second most federal child labor violations among neighboring states. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the state averaged 99 violations per year. During that same period, the Labor Department saw a 69% increase nationally in children being illegally employed. And some safety violations can be serious. Last year, a 16-year-old boy died from injuries sustained working at a northern Wisconsin sawmill. The company was fined nearly $200,000 for federal child labor violations. Tables fill a gymnasium at the local Boys and Girls Club during a recent job fair in Stevens Point. Students roam the room, stopping to speak with employers. Here's high school freshman Callie Marks on why she was looking for a summer job.
To start saving up for a vehicle and stuff and get that extra money and stuff.
For others, summer jobs provide a social setting.
I don't like just sitting around. It's more fun just doing stuff and being with people. I'm pretty social.
That's 14-year-old Marin Grancy. She plans to spend the summer working at the Door County Ice Cream Parlor. As employers prepare for the summer season, state officials say teens have become a more important part of the state's workforce. That's because baby boomers continue aging out. And that means questions about where they can work and under what conditions are not likely to go away. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. Smoke from Canadian wildfires triggered air quality advisories in our state earlier this month, with pollution levels becoming unhealthy for some people.
But how polluted is the air in your community? A group of Beloit residents realized they didn't have a clear understanding of their air quality, so they decided to measure it themselves. Using six air quality sensors on loan from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Beloit volunteers made an alarming discovery.
Their city's air quality had the worst measurement of particulate matter pollution in the United States. We turn to organizers of this community effort. Brittany Keyes is Clean Air Coordinator with Healthy Climate Wisconsin, and Pablo Toral is a professor of Environmental Studies and International Relations at Beloit College's School of Environment. Pablo, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Pablo, let's start with you. You helped coordinate this volunteer effort to test air quality in Beloit. What did you find out?
What we found out is that in 2023, Beloit had some of the highest indicators of air pollution in the entire country, particularly in the Midwest. We were not necessarily too far off from other nearby communities such as Milwaukee or Chicago, but we're certainly a little bit higher, which suggests that Beloit has all of the factors that lead to air pollution. The main source is combustion, and combustion is normally the result of three processes: manufacturing, tailpipe emissions from transportation, and power plants. And what we have in Beloit is all three of those. Some communities have one, some communities have two, and Beloit has all three. Add to that a very, very active and long fire season, wildfire season in Canada, and that led to the results that we had last year in 2023, which allowed us to track the impact of the wildfires in addition to the local sources of air pollution.
Okay, so that wildfire season compounding what is already there. Brittany, what is your reaction to the readings from these air quality sensors?
So we knew that Beloit, as Pablo, Professor Terrell shared, had higher industrial reported emissions to the EPA. And we have the public health metrics with high hospitalizations for asthma in youth that you would anticipate with higher pollution. We just had an issue that we weren't monitoring or very much under monitoring. So what our project was able to provide for us was data behind our hypothesis that we had a problem. And our specific analysis for our community science project, it ran from the end of 2022 to the early months of 2023. So our data did not capture the wildfire smoke. It showed that our particulate matter or soot pollution was 2 to 3 times higher than the World Health Organization of what they say is safe. So that was a reason for a call to action in itself. And then when the IQ Air report came, that provided comparative information capturing all of 2023. And that was startling. I'm a mom of 2 young kids. And to appreciate that, you know, now that we have this data, this is our designation. It's time for us to do something about it.
We hear the terminology particulate matter. Can you explain what particulate pollution is and the impact on our body's organs like the lungs?
Particulate matter pollution is essentially soot pollution that often comes from combustion of burning of fuel sources. They're very, very small molecules, much smaller than the diameter of a hair or grain of sand. And what happens is we breathe them in and they're so small, they go to the deepest aspects of our lungs and can be absorbed and actually enter our bloodstream and then circulate around and then end in different organs of the body. So particulate matter pollution can impact almost every system of our body and impacts our health negatively throughout the lifespan. And it has an accumulative effect. Specifically to the lungs, it can exacerbate asthma symptoms, increase hospitalizations, and exacerbate chronic pulmonary conditions. So the elderly as well. So it's a very important metric in air pollutant to monitor.
We're talking about volunteer testing of the air in Beloit and what the city has found in levels of particulate pollution compared to the U.S., the world. Brittany Keyes is with us, clean air coordinator with Healthy Climate Wisconsin, and Pablo Toral is a professor of environmental studies and international relations at Beloit College, where he's the chair of the environmental studies program. Pablo, I want to turn to the volunteerism effort of this air quality monitoring. Your group of volunteers requested sensors initially from the Environmental Protection Agency. What are these monitors like? What do they do?
If you will allow me, I'd like to take this project, if we can call it a project, back a decade. About a decade ago, I became very interested in working with the city of Beloit in coming up with a climate plan. And so I started to track some information on emissions of greenhouse gases. And when Dr. Keyes was a member of the city council at around 2020, if I remember correctly, 2019, 2020, I remember that the city was interested in coming up with a climate proclamation. I said, oh, excellent. Now we're getting some traction. So I reached out to the city council and I put together a report in which I basically documented the sources of greenhouse gas emissions in Beloit and pointed out some of the challenges that the community faced in terms of addressing, those emissions. If we really want to have a proclamation, we also need a plan. And the plan has to be based on some data as to where the sources of greenhouse gases are and how we come up with a plan to eliminate them by a particular target year. That's when I started to go back and forth with Dr. Keyes, and that's what really led the project to start getting momentum. So if you don't mind me, I'm going to pass it on to Dr. Keyes, who can answer the question.
Sure. But that really lays the foundation, Pablo, to understand the impetus behind where these monitors came from. Brittany, can you pick it up from here?
Yes. I reached out to the Wisconsin DNR, and at the time they were within federal guidelines for where their monitors were. We only have an ozone monitor on the far west side of town in Beloit, and that's a seasonal monitor. And so they recommended purple air monitors. So purple air particulate matter monitors. It's fairly accessible. They're about $200 to $300. And the DNR has a gold standard conversion factor that we can use to account for Wisconsin climate to come up with some pretty good community science-based data. And so the EPA has a loan program, and with the help and the support of Healthy Climate Wisconsin and an entity called Thriving Earth Exchange, we were able to organize a really solid and neat project to secure these monitors and a number of community partners, including two local high schools, service providers, local community centers, to really get a diverse setting of where all of these monitors were, as well as start monitoring where some of our most vulnerable live.
And so you had to recruit the volunteers, train them up to carry out the science and gathering the data from the monitors and maintaining them. What was that like?
Well, that's the fun part of the science project there. Working with the community partners, we were able to go into some classrooms and work with some of the high school students at Beloit Memorial High School and include them in on the project, have them register the sensor, help mount the sensor, and then they were able to work that into some of their projects in the high school. After we sent the EPA sensors back, we were able to get a little funding, secure sensors, and put them back up, and so to continue to work with some of these community partners.
I think that's such a key point, Pablo, because when you had to return the borrowed sensors from the EPA last fall, that you had a community response there saying, no, we want to continue to do this monitoring. What happened there?
Yeah, that was actually fantastic. In a way, the serendipity and the snowballing effect of this initial plan that I had, or lack of plan, interest in coming up with a climate strategy for Beloit, has really escalated into this community-led, community-based science project. My own students were very excited about this. And, you know, there was a student who put together, helped me put together a proposal to get money to install one of these sensors at Beloit College. We have other members of the community who reached out because they were interested. The League of Women Voters organized a series of talks, and that really helped us amplify, you know, the message, and that really led to more members of the community, different organizations reaching out. So this snowballing effect has been absolutely fantastic in terms of creating awareness, educating the population, and getting people, you know, to take matters into their own hands.
Brittany, why was it left to a group of volunteers to do this type of testing? You mentioned the seasonal monitors that the DNR had. Should the Environmental Protection Agency or the state DNR be monitoring for air quality in a more expansive way in Beloit and elsewhere?
So I have to recognize that they're working with what they have with respect to personnel and funding, and working within the guidelines that they're given as far as the DNR and working within the EPA guidelines. That being said, this is a great example of you don't know what you're not monitoring. And just because you're not monitoring doesn't mean there isn't a problem. So I think this is a great call for action and support of community science across the state, because the DNR only has monitors in 27 out of the 72 counties in Wisconsin. So I believe a lot of communities probably don't know what they're breathing. And once we start monitoring, we could get more answers. But we really do need that DNR or EPA monitor that's a gold standard regulatory monitor in order to start moving from reaction and awareness to actually implementing remediation and preventative action.
Pablo, what is your vision for next steps, and what do you want from state leaders, the DNR, as you continue to voluntarily gather this data?
Yes, I think we need regional action on it. Emissions in Beloit, in Broward County in general, are very large compared to the population that we have. And because the population is small, that means that institutional, economic, social, political resources are small as well. And the community is not going to have what it takes to come up with strategies to offset these emissions or to eliminate these emissions, which means that the plan moving forward has to be regional, has to be at the state level. This is a Wisconsin issue. This is a Midwest issue. Wisconsin, Illinois have to work together to address this.
Pablo, I'm going to give you the last word here, but it really sounds like finding those key partners is really important to doing this type of monitoring on the long term.
Yeah, that is correct. And I can't say that I have a perfect strategy to recommend because our project came together by, you know, very serendipitously. But it all starts with having a community that cares, having a community with people who want to work collectively with those who are interested in the health of the community. And if you have that, then you have the main part. The rest will come.
Well, Brittany and Pablo, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this work.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much for your interest.
Pablo Toral is a professor of environmental studies and international relations at Beloit College's School of Environment and Sustainability. And Brittany Keyes is clean air coordinator with Healthy Climate Wisconsin. We've been learning about the work of volunteers in Beloit who are testing and monitoring the local air quality as part of an ongoing community science initiative.
Coming up, we'll meet a father and son team documenting Wisconsin's unique effigy mounds and their role in Ho-Chunk culture.
These sites have a lot of power, have a lot of energy.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to places built on or around effigy mounds that were created by indigenous people centuries ago.
And a lot of work goes into finding those mounds and putting them on the map.
A father and son team of Ho-Chunk caretakers of the mounds has been traveling around the state to identify and survey them for decades, starting in the late 1980s with a site on land owned by Muscadet farmer Frank Shadowald.
Richie Brown is an elder of the Ho-Chunk Nation and a former manager of the Ho-Chunk Department of Natural Resources. And his son, Casey Brown, is a comedian, award-winning documentary producer, and member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Richie, thanks for joining us.
It was my son that convinced me to make the trip down, so here I am. I'm glad to be here.
Casey, thanks for coming, and thanks for bringing your dad along.
Thank you for having the both of us here.
Richie, can you start off by telling us what effigy mounds are for people who may have heard of the mounds but don't really know what they are?
Well, Wisconsin's unique in that we're about the only place in the country that'll have effigy mounds. It's along the Wisconsin River up the Mississippi River. And if you go up to Wisconsin all the way to the headwaters of the Wisconsin, you'll find them there and you'll find them. There's a portage there that takes you into the Ontonagon River and up into the Lake Superior. They're along there, too. They're in the UP, too. So it's unique to the country. This is the only place you'll find them. In southern Wisconsin, there's just a ton of them. And then here in Madison, you know, the Capitol was built on effigy mounds. So, and what they are is the effigy mounds is different from just being a there's a lot of mounds around that are just conicals or linears, but these are actually made in shapes of animals or entities or birds are, you know, I've seen fox mounds, there's otter mounds, eagle mounds, bear mounds, you name it, they're out there.
Now, Richie, how did you get involved in working with these effigy mounds?
Well, what brought us or started this was way back in 88. Back then, I was the head of the Ho-Chunk DNR in Black River Falls. So when I first started surveying these and looking at all these mounds, I was real interested and fascinated, but I didn't know half the story then. I just knew what they were, but I didn't understand the power they hold and the power they still hold and what they mean to the people that built them and the fact that we're still visiting them. That's the key to all this, is that they're still being used. So it's an amazing journey we've been on for a long time. And when I started that, Casey wasn't quite this old as he is today. So, but being a dad, I used to, whenever I was on the road and he was available, I'd take him along. So he just kind of got used to being in the truck, because we covered a lot of ground, and we went from a lot of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the UP, and Ohio, Indiana, and then went to Canada a few times.
Sounds like you two really traveled all over the place. Casey, can you talk a little bit about what it was like growing up, going to these mounds and seeing that part of the history of this place we live?
Well, as you can tell, my dad said we were going to all these places. Even today, sometimes I have to look at him and someone will ask me, they're like, oh, have you seen this mound? And I'll have to look to my dad. He's like, yes, we've been there. Because, you know, being a little kid, I'd have a book or maybe a Game Boy. I obviously wanted to be doing something else, like every little kid. But going out there, I knew that it was important, and I knew we were tromping around the woods for some sort of reason. And gradually, as I've gotten older, I really appreciate it that I had, you know, it was a very unique childhood. And especially, I know a lot of people that spent time with their dad doing stuff, but it was, what we were doing was something very different. And I didn't fully grasp it at the time. And even as, you know, my father said, like, you know, I kind of knew about it and I knew what was going on, but at more and more, the mounds have, as I've grown older, they've meant different things to me.
And Richie, the two of you have done a lot of this work finding and marking these mounds. There's a bigger team behind these efforts, too. Can you talk about who you've been working with, collaborating with, to do this amazing project?
Well, I work with a nonprofit. It's Ancient Footprints. And there we've got one of the principals in it. It was Steve Solberg. He's a land surveyor over in La Crosse. And then another guy that works with us running the GPR is Ben Hansen. He's a civil engineer out of Viroqua. And then we've got a soil scientist out of Galesville, Emery Palmer, Highcliffe. They volunteer their time all the time. You know, if you need anything, they're right with you. And Ben's also a pilot, so if we need to go somewhere quick, he'll get us there. So, like I said, we've done a lot. We've been up in the UP quite a few times. We've been to Beaver Island. And anytime you ask them if they want to go along, they'll just set aside whatever they're working on, and they'll join the party, because it's something that takes you places you've never been.
Now, Casey, you mentioned you didn't necessarily fully appreciate things when you were a kid. Now, obviously, that's changed. You're working on a documentary about your father's work and about the mounds here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Certainly. So one thing that my father was talking about is just kind of the crew of people. And that's what's so interesting, is it really is a motley crew. And I like to call them the mounds heroes. It's folks that as he said, you know, emeritus professors to farmers, just people that these mounds have like touched their lives in one way or another. And it's both native and non-native people that really that are affected by these earthworks. So I to my own horn, I recently won an Emmy. And of course, I won that when I was working with the Ho-Chunk Nation for a piece on Truman Lowe, a bio piece on the artist Truman Lowe. So, of course, folks are asking, well, what's your next project going to be? And, this was seemed like a very obvious choice because it's something I, you know, I've been talking about and I've been working with my father on, and a lot of folks don't know about it. And I guess I kind of have a lot of just knowledge about mounds. My base knowledge on mounds is, I think, a lot higher than most people. So there's a lot of, there are other videos out there about mounds, but what the film that I'm looking to make is, it's a documentary that's more indigenous focused from an indigenous perspective. And even the format, instead of it just being sort of linear, like here we're going to start and end talking about mounds, it goes through the entire seasons, because ultimately these mounds, it's important to see them throughout the year because they mean something, as my dad said. You know, Frank noticed it at a specific time where in the winter, where you're right there, where you can see the sunset. All these mounds are going to be very different through the year. And it's just interesting to look at it from a different way where it's not necessarily just fully based on the archaeology, but also the indigenous perspective and, you know, how people are affected by them, both native and non-native.
I wanted to ask you about that, Richie. Are a lot of effigy mounds lined up in conjunction with the seasons, the sun, the stars?
A lot of these sites are aligned with different times. And the interesting part about that is the stories that go with them, because when we went to, we started, like I said, at Frank's property down in Muscadet, and there at that time, Frank was a retired farmer, and he just had an interest in what was there. But then once I got involved, I decided to see what our traditional court or our elders knew about this. So I took the time to ask. First, I went to our traditional court leaders, which is the elders in each clan, and talked to them. And they had some idea, but then they said, well, the stories are out there. Maybe you should take some more elders down there. So what we did is we set up a tour where I actually had casino buses, and I loaded them up with elders. We took them down there for the day and had a lunch for them, took them down, showed them the mounds. And then at the end of the day when we took them all home, I gave them all my card with a phone number on. I said, so if anything, you think of anything, just give me a call. I got on one of the buses that was there with the going down the mounds, and as soon as we got down on right on the riverbank there, they were getting out of the buses, and the ladies in front of me got a big grin on their face, and they're looking at each other, and can you hear it? And what they could hear was drums. So they knew they were somewhere important, but see that I wasn't quite in tune with things at that time, so I didn't hear them, but I'm glad they heard them. So what I got back then, eventually I got the name of the site was a Ho-Chunk name, and it was where the eagle sits down. You know, when the eagle lands, it adjusts its wings. Well, that's what the name of the village site was. The Ho-Chunk people have been in the area in Wisconsin for two ice ages. So our stories go way back.
Casey, I want to ask you a couple questions. First of all, hearing your dad talk about the elders, hearing the drums when they saw this mound, can you talk a little bit about the power, the response you see from people when they maybe see some of these mounds for the first time and realize and make the connections with them?
I think that's something I've been thinking about. Think about all the time, just how they affect me. But especially when people see them for the first time, it's just like you can like take a look at pictures. I even have this problem going in with the film is trying to transfer, like when you're there and seeing it and witnessing these mounds, it's not just, you know, ostensibly it's a clump of dirt. It's just a pile of dirt. But once you're actually there and you see it, and the big thing is they're not just, these mounds aren't just placed in willy-nilly. They're put in places for specific reasons, pointing different ways. And you have to be in the landscape and you have to be able to look around to take everything in to see, you know, perhaps you're right next to a river, you're near some water, there's, you know, big hills over here. So I think the majesty of the mounds is hard to transfer just by a picture or even a film or video. But, you know, that's the hard task of trying to capture it. But seeing people actually go to them for the first time, and that's, you know, native and non-native people, just knowing and taking a look at it. And then once you learn about the amount of work, you know, thinking with hands and maybe, you know, a shovel or a hoe made out of bone and a basket made out of reeds. That's how these mounds were made, when it's dump trucks full of dirt that were brought, you know, not even on top of the land, but going underneath as well. And dirt, not just from, you know, just a couple 20 feet over, but even miles away. So once you actually learn about them and figure out how they were made, it's you certainly feel something when you're there.
And Casey, a lot of these, as you mentioned, are on private land. Some farmers are going to be very willing. Landowners will be very willing to work with you. Others may not know what they have. When it comes to surveying and marking and now filming your documentary, what are some of the challenges in making those connections with the people who are now the deed holders for the land these mounds are on?
I got to tell you, and every time, even as I've been listening through this interview, I'm always learning from my father and how to do that. He's been doing this for years. And, you know, I'm certainly... you know, my dad's quieter than me. I'm certainly more of the type A, really loud. There's a joke. So actually, one of my uncles told me this joke. So we're Bear Clan. Bear Clan's kind of, we take care of the earth and, you know, kind of general infantry as well. So even our powwows, we have Bear Clan security. So Bison Clan or Buffalo Clan, those are people that talk. You know, if you go to a powwow, that's like traditionally the MC would be there. So I had an uncle that always was making fun of, you know, it's like, you sure your mom wasn't rolling with a Buffalo Clan guy? And like, I look a lot like my dad, so it's obviously like not, but I, you know, I'm certainly more talkative, but I think just watching him and seeing how he interacted with a lot of these folks, just especially building those relationships. And just as he said, like talking with elders and like, here's my card and going to them and not just expecting people to come to you and to make that effort. And especially with folks that have been there, you know, some of these farmers have generations, their family have been there. And I can see just, you know, some young native guy coming in like, hey, by the way, you know, I have more provenance to this than you do. Let me come here. This is my thing. You can't walk in like that, obviously. And not to mention, you know, these people have their own stories now, and those are just as important. I mean, they have perhaps like hundreds of years of stories just talking, you know, their family had been there that long. So it's important to, when you walk in, to be cognizant of that as well and to be respectful to everyone.
Richie, you've done so much to share the mounds with your son, with the next generation, your own family, and the next generation, period. Why is it important to you that future generations are going to be able to go and see these mounds that you're working on right now?
These sites have a lot of power, have a lot of energy, and that's why you have to be real careful and respectful of what you do there, too. But it's some amazing stuff, and it's an amazing opportunity, and that's what I want, to be able to share this stuff with the younger generation, because the way things are today in society in general, they need something to hang on to, just to guide them through everything that's going on today. So, and that's what we're trying to do, is leave something for the younger generation.
That's a great place to leave it. Richie and Casey, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Richie and Casey Brown from the Ho-Chunk Nation about their work surveying and marking effigy mounds around the state and what those mounds mean to Native and non-Native communities here in Wisconsin.
TikTok is a top social media platform for a lot of people, but it's gotten tangled up in politics.
A federal law passed earlier this year says TikTok's China-based owners need to sell the company or find it blocked here in the U.S.
So we want to find out, what, if anything, TikTok means to you. Do you consume TikTok videos? Do you produce them as a part of your professional or maybe your career identity? Would you miss it if TikTok went away?
Or maybe somebody in your family is a heavy user. Maybe your kids TikTok and they don't stop.
Tell us your TikTok story. Call or text 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Get in touch. We can share your story in a future conversation.
Thank you. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.